part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm gonna do it part. I'm gonna do it part-time. I'm gonna do it part. Fanboy.com.
It was the time of the preacher, when the story began, of the choice of a lady, the love of a man. How he loved her so dearly, he went out of his mind when she left him.
Hey, can you hear me?
I can hear you just
fine. Oh, all right. Okay, I had to switch mics. Everyone's going to be able to hear everything in this room, but
everything.
I think another headset just died on me. I cannot believe
it. Oh, man. And dude, you are hard on me.
I don't get it. It's like the fifth one I've had while recording this podcast, and this is like a gaming headset,
dude,
you know?
It's like for those of you who don't believe the podcast like are not a full contact event, this is proof, man.
It's absolutely ridiculous. I cannot believe it. So there's probably going to be a little bit of reverb on my end of the microphone. You're probably going to hear some...
Cool. You'll sound like a badass or something.
Yeah, bounce. Like, there's bounce. It's a big room, so... And I don't feel like putting soundproof stuff all over the walls.
Unless you, the listeners, can chip in for some soundproofing.
But. Yeah, right. I'm not pulling down all my posters and geek stuff. Anyway, all right. Well, here we go. Another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. And we were all set and ready to go, and Christian had mic problems.
Well, I wouldn't say we were set and ready to go, because let me tell you about the day I had. I got up, slept in, started doing yoga, had a great morning, and then I got a text from a friend of mine that's like, hey, are you planning to show up at work?
Oh, snap.
Yeah, I thought I was supposed to start work tomorrow. I actually started today. So, yeah, that immediately sort of consumed my entire day. So I've been running a little behind today. but you know what?
Gotcha. We're here.
On days when you've, you know, whether you've had a perfect day or whether you've had a day where you're running a little behind, if you can finish your day talking about Preacher, that's a damn fine day.
Damn straight. So this is another episode of the Part-Time Fanboy Book Club. We haven't done one of these in a while.
We haven't.
We have not.
I look forward to these, man.
Yeah. And this is a particularly good one. We were originally going to talk about John Byrne's Man of Steel, but John Byrne has been such a prick in the news lately that I decided to put the kibosh on that. And what we're talking about this week is Preacher Gone to Texas, right?
Right. The first of the, you know, sort of divided, you know, graphic novel collection. What do they call those?
The trade paperbacks.
Trade paperbacks. The first of the trade paperbacks, for those who are paying attention.
Yes.
I don't know about you, how your collection looks, but I've got like the first like two or three issues in single, you know, the single book. And then for some reason, I don't know what it was, like, it didn't grab me the first time I read it.
You mean the original run, or like
the original
when you first
run
read them?
When I first read it, like the first issue, it didn't grab me at the time.
No.
And it was like maybe a year or two later that somebody had told me that, like, you know, you really should look back at this book. Like, and I actually got the trade paperback and went through, and then, like, my perspective had changed, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's all I can say is that, like, I had a new perspective on life, and, like, the new perspective I had really clicked with this book.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about, like, Preacher Gone to Texas is the first 7 issues of the series.
That's
like,
right.
And that's kind of what we reread, but we'll probably just talk about Preacher, like, in general, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we'll try to keep everything, like, specifically to this book, because I'd really like to extend this talk out, like, to all the books, because, like, man, there's so many good moments in this series. Like, yeah. I really give them all their credit and all their due. And it's one of those series that, man, you could just keep talking about it for hours and hours
Forever.
And hours.
Still it's
have
so
stuff
good.
To say about it. You know?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. Did you know that it's been 20 years since this series, like, premiered? Like, I had the first, I have, like, the whole run, like, individual issues. And and I lent, like, the first 12 or so to a friend and never got them back. So there's a guy out there, his name is Jason Tobin. He has my first 12 issues of Preacher, and I want him back. I want him back if you still have him. Of course.
Jason Tobin, you're on notice. I'm not saying that he won't send the Saint of Killers after you.
It's
but
true.
It's a possibility.
It's true. I should send the Saint of Killers after him. I want my books back. So apparently this series premiered in 1995, and it was a Vertigo imprint. Which, for people who don't know, that's part of DC Comics when they were branching out into, like, independent books. And,
right.
Or Vertigo. Stuff that wasn't superhero stuff.
Yeah, Vertigo from the late 80s to the mid 90s was, like, sort of classic comic book run. I mean, like, it's the kind of thing that they'll look back in the comic history books or tablets or Kindles or whatever the fuck they're writing.
Yeah.
And they're going to look back at that and say, what an amazing run of books and creators there were working at this, working on these books at this time.
Yeah. Did you know that a lot of the original trade paperbacks, and I even think one run of the recollected ones where they collected like 12 issues at a time, they're like not in print. Like you can get them at comic shops and stuff, and you can kind of order them on Amazon, but like Preacher Gone to Texas itself, like, you can't buy that, like, off of Amazon. Like, you have to get, like, the 12 issue collected run, and even Amazon is not selling, like, book 3 or book 4 or something like that of the re-released, you know, hardcovers and
stuff. I'm sure that'll all change once you know, the TV series starts rolling out.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about what Preacher is about, because quite honestly, it's very interesting to me. I mean, I went back and, you know, obviously reread the first 7 issues and the first trade, and you know, there's a lot of stuff in there. Like, there's a lot of stuff that gets established, like, from the outset, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this book has a fantastic beginning. I mean, they establish the premise of the book in such a great, great way.
Yeah.
Because they do it a lot through dialogue, a lot through showing you things. And, I mean, from the first issue, you really know what you're getting.
Yeah. I mean, they really... If for some reason I thought that this series, like, dragged out, like, certain aspects of itself, like, for a long time, but in the first 4 issues alone, you're getting, like, so much stuff established, you know, from...
Well, let's just start off on the first page. I mean, the first page starts out at, like, the Five Aces Diner. It's your typical diner in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And it throws you immediately into sort of Reservoir Dogs style dialogue, you know, where, like, you know, they're sort of talking about things that are off topic, but it's a weird group of people sitting around a table. You've got a guy dressed like a minister.
Yeah.
You know, but he's got, like, long hair, and he smokes, and he's, like, foul mouth. You've got like sort of white trash looking girl, like, with a weird haircut bob and everything.
Yeah.
And you've got, like, this crazy Irishman who never takes off his sunglasses.
Yeah, his red sunglasses. Yeah. His, like, red tinted sunglasses. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned the sort of Reservoir Dog sort of Pulp Fiction sort of thing, because that's the thing that I bounced back to this time reading it. I was like, oh, this is very sort of Tarantino-esque, like, framing, you know,
sequence,
you know, and Yeah. So you could tell that we didn't even say who worked on this series. It's by Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon.
Steve Dillon.
And they do a really good job of sort of like establishing that, hey, these three have been brought together by something, and this is going to be the framework of the story that we're in. It's sort of like a framing sequence.
And one of the things I'm going to say again, I've said this before time and time again, but this is one of the most amazing, consistent artistic teams. Garth Ennis, Steve Dillon, the entire book. Covers were by Glenn Fabry, the entire book.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was like a very single voice in a way that a lot of the other comics didn't have. Even Sandman, you know, like Neil Gaiman's like an incredibly strong, you know, authorial voice, but like he had so many different artists who worked on it and everything. Like it felt like a bigger tapestry. And this just feels like, you know, sort of like in a way like auteur filmmaking, you know, this is auteur comic book making.
Yeah. It's really interesting because I remember when the series was out, there were a lot of people who gave Steve Dillon some kind of crap, like for his art, like being too simplistic or not as like complex as like what people in Image were doing, like with cross-hatching and crazy line work and stuff like that. But the thing is I always loved his work. I thought his work was like solid. I thought it was very established, and like reading, like leafing through the first issue, I'm very impressed with how, you know, his storytelling works.
Dude, his composition is incredible.
It's absolutely fantastic.
He uses like negative space in a way that is really fun to look at.
Yeah.
When he has like an action sequence, like they're very laid out and easy to understand. I mean, even to the fact like, and this is kind of a goofy thing, like, you know, in movies when they cross the line.
Yeah. Yeah.
You ever
watch
a movie where like they cross the line and you're just like, oh, like that was some bad like editing or directing or whatever.
Yeah,
like
The 180 action, line.
Exactly. The 180 line. It's almost like his action sequences follow those rules. Like he, you know, like everything just flows to tell the story. Like it moves the story along perfectly.
Yeah.
He can be like incredibly like active in action, or he can be really funny, you know?
Yeah,
A lot of really funny stuff in here.
Or just like really, really sort of like he can really establish a mood of a character. He's really great with expressions.
Yeah.
You know
what
I mean?
Some of his backgrounds are terrifying. Like, you know, when he goes and does like a splash page.
Yeah.
He like commands the page.
Yeah, he's really good at like making the setting real, you know, like making things real in their space and stuff like that. There was never a moment reading these first seven issues and from what I recall reading the whole series where I ever felt like he was phoning it in, or I ever felt like, you know, that that I wasn't fully engaged in the story. And a lot of that has to do with the writing, but a ton of it has to do with Steve Dillon's art. Like, I don't even know what he's currently working on, if he's still even in comics. I mean, quite honestly, this is the very first time since the series ended, you know, all those years ago, that I've actually gone back and looked at this series, you know? Like, the thing is I have to say, reading the first seven issues, I mean, I plan on rereading the whole series again because it's so good. I mean, I can't, like, we were hanging out the other night, and we kind of touched on it a little bit because we were with friends, but the thing that just it just took my breath away again. Like, Preacher is one of those, well, I mean, I'll just say it, I honestly, even especially after rereading the first seven issues, I've thought this for a long time, but I think that Preacher is probably like my favorite comic book series ever. Like, I know that's a bold statement, and like, but there's something in this series that just like hits all the right notes for me.
Yeah.
And just like, and the final issue, I remember us talking about it because we were friends by then, by the time the final issue came out. I think it's the only comic that I remember making me cry. And not necessarily because it was something so devastating or something like that, but it was, I really felt like I was saying goodbye to friends, you know what I mean? Like, I really felt like, I was like, this is it. Like, I'm never going to see these people again. And it's the only time I've ever read a comic and had that feeling, like almost like when you read a really great, like, book or a novel, you know, where you're like, oh man, you don't want it to end. And I remember not wanting Preacher to end. I always wanted Jesse Custer, you know, Tulip and Cassidy, like, around. You know, I always wanted that Trinity to work out. Even though, you know, spoilers, by the end of the series, Cassidy's kind of a scumbag.
There's no way it can. I mean, it's one of those things that, in a way, like, that makes it more beautiful, because it's one of those things that, like, was just magic at a time. But it couldn't last. And that's the way, you know, that's the way a lot of the best stories go.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's just address, I mean, I keep saying, like, let's just address the first couple issues. But, you know, it's such a story that looms so large in my psyche that it's like, I can't just address the first arc without, like, what comes after it.
Well, I mean, let's face it. It starts off with, like, the biggest issue of all time. I mean, this is a book that starts off with, you know, the nature of God.
Yeah.
Like, from the first page, it's asking, like, big questions, but in a way that's not, like, you know, ponderous or anything.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, literally the characters are looking for God.
Yeah.
What are they doing? Like, they're looking for God. And that's all you need to know. Like, it's an incredible setup. I love the fact that you get that, like, literally in the first two panels. Like, where are you going to start looking for him? Texas is as good a place as any. And of course, it's like, it's just a bold book, man. Like, I mean, like, right there, it's
You're
sort
not
of
kidding.
Like, it sets you up. Like, we're not going to fuck around with this. We're going to go and this book goes to very dark places, and it goes to funny places, and, like, that's what makes it such an awesome book, because, like, I remember reading it issue to issue and just not knowing what was going to happen next, you know, and, like, that month in between issues actually being, like, you know, like, wow, what's going to happen?
How's that?
In a way that, like, you don't get with even TV shows like now.
Yeah, it's kind of a lost art, especially even in comics. You know, it definitely is a lost art where it's, you know, sort of, and it was kind of like cliffhangers without being a cliffhanger, or there weren't even really cliffhangers. It was just like, you were so eager to, at least for me, I was so eager to get back in touch with these characters that, like, I couldn't wait month to month to read this book. And it was, and whenever it came out, it was the very first thing on my pull pile that I read. Like, as soon as I sat down with whatever stack of comics I would get that week, like, it was the very first thing that I read. And, I don't recall any other comic being like that for me, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, basically the story starts off with these three. They're in a diner. They're talking about something. They're talking about looking for someone or going on a quest or something like that. And then you sort of skip back in time to Jesse Custer, to when he's actually a preacher in a small town. And it sort of establishes the story there, where you sort of get a feeling that he's the very disenfranchised preacher in the town.
He's had enough, you know.
He's
spent his life, you know, trying to work with these people and everything like that. And one day he's just fed up. What reminds me of is the beginning of Cool Hand Luke.
Yeah.
You know, where he's just drunk and he's fed up with life. And so he just goes and, like, shaves the heads off of all the parking meters in town. Why does he do it? Because he's just had enough. You know, he's just lost it. And what Jesse Custer does is just goes into this bar and lays the entire town's secrets out in front of them. He's just like, oh, you want to be real? Like, we're going to be honest here.
Yeah.
And he gets his ass kicked.
Yeah. Well, I think what they, you know, and this is very much about the character, like, there's an incident that he refers to that sets him off, which is, you know, a girl who gets raped, assaulted, and, you know, nobody pays for the crime because somebody's, you know, somebody's related to a judge in town or in the county, and they got they get away with it. And so I think that is the thing that just that's the thing that sets him off. And it very much like establishes that this guy has a line that you don't want to cross. And he has a code of honor. Mm-hmm. And this is where it sort of gets established. Like, yeah, I'm not dealing with this anymore. Like, he's almost like that guy, Howard Beale in Network. Where it's like, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore.
But at the same time, it also sets him out as a classic Western figure.
You know?
He's like Gary Cooper or something like that. You know, you definitely... Like, this book is a Western in a lot of ways. And, you know, it starts in Texas. You know, the South and Western movies really are like Jesse's sort of influence, you know, especially to a huge degree that you find out later in the book, John Wayne.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, immediately, you know, he's the good guy.
Yeah.
You know, like you get a great impression of who he is, but you also know, yeah, he's a good guy. And like you, and you want to be on this guy's side.
Yeah. 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 It's, you know, that he doesn't take any crap. He walks the line. Mm-hmm. He's very basically like every good guy and every, you know, old like Western song that you've ever, you know, heard about. Like he's like Johnny Cash. He's like you said, Gary Cooper. You know, so it's interesting. He's got a dark side, but you know, there's a morality that he plays by, you know?
Yeah. And then it flashes into heaven.
Yes.
Like you go from this diner in Texas and the next thing you're in heaven.
Yeah.
Which has this weird sort of like bird design with like a sci-fi. It's like almost like a Mobius kind of a heaven.
Yeah.
Like their design actually reminded me a little bit of like, you remember that Frank Miller book, Ronin?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah. It had a little bit of that with like sort of like those weird sketchy panels and everything like that. And you know, you find out that something has broken out of heaven.
Yeah.
And, you know, the angels are all about to look for it. And also,
that
for
there's
some
a
reason,
class system in heaven, too.
That there's a class system in heaven, you know, that you've got like a group.
Two different types of angels.
Two different kinds of angels. One are like the warrior, you know, priests who are sort of in charge of everything.
Yeah.
And then there's like the lower angels who look more like people, and they're... basically the scientists and the ones who keep everything sort of moving.
Yeah.
And God's nowhere to be found.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically it comes down to like something big has happened and the sort of warrior class of angels is saying to the other guys, like, you guys need to take care of this because, and they're like, well, you're the ones that kind of like, let them, you know what I mean? They're sort of like going back and forth.
It's blame shifting. It's like, I mean, it's hilarious. I mean, like you go into heaven and you're seeing like basically all of our, you know, problems that we have magnified on like a cosmic scale.
Yeah. And I guess, yeah, the warrior class is called the Seraphim.
Yeah.
And I can't remember what the other one is, but yeah.
Adelphi.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. The Adelphi. Yeah. Yeah. And so essentially you get like sort of like you need to take care of this. And the three lower caste angels kind of like talked with the obviously the lowest man on the totem pole. They're like, you got to go wake the saint of killers. And I was like, I remember reading that first issue and being like, wow, they introduced the saint of killers like already in this first chapter. I was just blown away by how much was established in the very beginning,
first book. And then, you know, they flash back to the diner and, you know, you find the girl story. Basically, you sort of get like a little bit of backstory on each one of the three that's sitting around that around that table.
Yeah.
Find out that Tulip and Jesse have a past.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And that she met up with the Irish one, Cassidy.
Yeah.
Basically because she was attempting a hit on someone.
On like a politician or something. Like, yeah. You don't even really know. Yeah. Yeah. And the hit goes
wrong. And she messed it up really bad.
Yeah. She totally screws up the hit. Yeah.
You get one of those like the first view of like the sort of comedic violence that goes on in this book on that page, because she basically blows someone's lower jaw off and he's sitting there.
He's just sitting like, there
staring at his tongue hanging out of his mouth with this like dumbfounded expression on his face, and it's horrible, but it's so funny.
Well, it's really great. Are you looking at the page right now? Because because he's sitting there with this horrible look. He's not screaming or anything, and the guy next to him is like, well, what are you doing? Go get her, you know? And the other guy's looking at the guy with his face blown off, and he has a great, like, Steve Dillon's expressions are so fantastic in this, because it's like, he's looking at the guy with the face blown off, and you can tell he's like, yeah, I don't know that I want to go do that. You know what I mean? Like, that looks really bad. So yeah, definitely. She's running away from a hit gone wrong, and she runs into Cassidy, who's
singing a Pogue song and, you know, just chilling out in his truck.
Yeah. And she points a gun in his face, and he's not intimidated like at all by it. He's like, you know, whatever.
Yeah, which should be her first sign that something's wrong, but she's in a little bit of a jam, so she doesn't care.
Yeah, yeah, because at this point, the guy's bodyguards are running after her, and they take off, and basically, he kind of gets dinged in the head by a bullet. And, you know, we get introduced to Cassidy. And that's all you get of Cassidy in this first issue. Like, they reveal a little bit about Jesse. They reveal a little bit about Tulip, you know. But Cassidy, he's kind of like the enigma. He's sort of like the cool punk rocker, you know, guy that, you know, you don't know anything about, but you know that something's up. Like, and I can't quite remember, you know, spoiler to anyone who's not read the book, I don't know if I was clued into that fact that he was a vampire, like in this first issue. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they did. They were not really particularly like telegraphing that.
Yeah, at this point. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I mean, you just knew that there was something a little off about the guy.
Yeah, yeah. You just knew that something was weird. You know, you didn't know what it was. And then, so basically, like, the story in this first issue progresses, and you kind of get sort of the lowdown on how they all got reunited, you know?
Right. And we get their first glimpse of the Saint of Killers. The Adelphi, the low dude on the totem pole.
Yeah.
You just call him the red shirt at this point.
Like the intern. Yeah.
Goes down this stairway into a pit full of skulls with a coffin on top that has a rattlesnake.
Yeah.
It's just a creepy image. And he wakes up a guy who immediately shoots him in the face.
Yeah, blows him up. And he's not dead yet. Like, he's, you know, the Saint of Killers demands an explanation.
Yeah.
And the guy with the back of his head blown off is able to still talk and explain what it is they need of him.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know whether that's, you know, angel physiology or just like the force of will of the Saint of Killers.
Yeah.
Because the Saint of Killers, as we find out, is a badass motherfucker.
Yeah, totally.
He is. Did you ever read the Saint of Killers miniseries?
A long time ago. It's really good.
The Saint of Killers is essentially a cowboy who was screwed over in life.
Yeah.
You know, like, he is basically, in the afterlife, he becomes God's executioner.
Yeah, yeah.
He's given guns that never miss their target and never run out of ammo.
Yeah.
And he's just completely unstoppable. If Clint Eastwood were a Terminator, then he would be maybe a tenth of the Saint of Killers.
Yeah.
The Saint of Killers is the scariest fucking character, I think, in comic books.
Yeah, probably. I think you're right, because there's absolutely no mercy, and he's mystical. He's not like a Terminator, because you can't stop him. And the only thing that stops him is later on we discover, you know, that eventually some of the plot comes out, like what some of the backstory comes out when the Saint of Killers, you know, is revealed. You know, the angel tells him that there's a being that has escaped from heaven. Mm-hmm. And we sort of get the details later on that basically what happened was that I don't know if an angel and a demon fell in love or
they just fucked, or
yeah, or they like, just had sex, or
you know. although I'll be honest with you, like this book sort of blurs the line up between a lot of the things some of the times, like relationships in this book are super messy. And that's one of the things that I think makes it such an awesome book, and one of the reasons it stands the test of time, because it's not just asking like the big, you know, theological questions or anything. It's really concerned with how we get along with each other as people.
Yeah.
And every person in this book has their own like unique voice and their own will to live, and like, you know, and at times it's a battle between these people.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, ultimately it's about how we get along with each other as people, and sometimes they act in ways that they haven't thought out, and they make stupid decisions, and like they're so real, man. Like that's the thing I think I love about all three of them, and the reason why I wanted to spend more time with them is because all three of those like seem the most real comic book characters to me.
Well, they're so fully fleshed out, you know. I mean, they're so, even just from the beginning, the whatever, you know, Ennis does to flesh them out or make them real. Like, I think the thing that draws me into this book is just the sense of friendship and loyalty, even mm-hmm. among people who, you know, we've all had friends that aren't like the best to us, or we don't always agree with or always get along with. But for me, like, so much of this book isn't even about like what you said, how we relate to people. It's about friendship and how mm-hmm. complex they are, and loyalty, and how loyalty can be tested, and that loyalty means something. You know what I mean? And that to me is like the greatest theme running through the whole series. You know what I mean? Like, just how far can you go? And, you know, also love, like what, how much can you forgive somebody who screwed you over? And how much can you go back and be with your sort of like one true love, like Jesse and Tulip kind mm-hmm. of do? And it's just, it's just such a, I feel like a very deep book that just explores like these themes that might be corny in another writer and artist's hands, but mm-hmm. here they do such a good job of just, you know, drawing out the pathos in it, that it's really impactful. Like the whole thing, like even just looking through this first issue, you know what I mean? They just do such a good job. And I think that this first issue was it a double sized issue? I think it was definitely more than
it was
your standard. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, but during the course of the issue, during the course of the series, and especially this issue, like, it's so smart because it interjects like all these mystical like events. Like basically you discover that Jesse has been possessed by this thing called Genesis, which is the offspring mm-hmm. of the angel and the demon. And it gives him this ability to use sort of like the word of God, right?
Yeah, basically it's anything that he says happens.
Yeah.
Pretty much. You know, people have to obey his voice. If you hear what he says, then you must do it.
Yeah. Like when he uses it, you have to do exactly what he says. So it's like some kind of bizarre kind of mind control that mm-hmm. you can't resist, that nobody can resist. Even the Saint of Killers can't resist, you know? But the thing is like what's great about it, and what you find out as the book goes on, is that he's not willing to just use it willy-nilly, right? He's got a code again, and he's like, this is how I'm going to use it, and you know, I'm not going to just use it to get drinks, free drinks at a bar, or you know, I have a responsibility, which is something that they sort of explore in the second issue, I think, or the third. But you know, these first four issues of the series are very much like lay the groundwork for everything that comes before it. And I mean, after it, excuse me. And it's just incredible how much they fit into these first four issues, because I was so surprised. Like, quite honestly, like there was a part of me that was like, did they only think it was going to last four issues? Because, you know, as I, you get,
because
to this,
it wraps up so perfectly.
Yeah, too. Exactly.
Yeah. One of the things that, you know, I think really worked super well in this book were its like little arcs within the overall story. You know, like some of the arcs would be, you know, 4 to 7 issues. Others would only go, you know, 2 or 3 issues. But like the pacing on this series is impeccable.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think again, and I don't know if a lot of that is due to Ennis's like panel breakdowns or Dylan's, you know, artwork and storytelling. I mean, I think it's a little bit of both. But, you know, while I was reading this, I was like, damn, this is like storyboards. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's like every moment is precisely, you know, picked at and you know, picked apart and laid out and plotted. And it's just like the framing of everything. I mean, right now I'm looking through what I think is like the second issue, and you know, the sequence where the Saint of Killers faces off against the police and they're just getting blown away.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you just get this sense of timing where it's like blam, blam, blam. Like it's just, it's almost like a time bomb ticking. It's like, oh my God, how much more can this go on? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I love like the little like things that they do in here, like the fact that they never show the Saint of Killers draw a gun.
Yeah.
Like he never needs to draw his guns. The guns are just there when he needs them.
Yeah. You never see him grabbing for them, really.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, really cool stuff. So the reason why the Saint of Killers is after them, the reason why, you know, is he's possessed by Genesis, but also we find out that basically God has just left heaven.
Yeah. He went to Earth
and really didn't give any information to anybody about anything.
And leave anybody in charge, really.
And so there's a big sort of power scramble up in heaven, then the Genesis breakout happens, and like for the first time in, you know, since really the beginning of time, no one's sure what's going to happen anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Like basically God has abdicated his responsibilities and has said, I'm done. Like when Genesis was born or created, God just figured he couldn't handle it anymore for some reason. And you start to discover sort of in some of the revelations that occur, no pun intended, during the book, that you know, God actually, it might be afraid of Genesis because he thinks that whatever that creature is might be more powerful than him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he just kind of checks out. In the meantime, you know, Jesse's got this power, and there's a lot of chaos going down, you know, on Earth. And we get introduced to, you know, Sheriff Root. Right?
Oh, Sheriff Root.
Yeah. Who ends up being one of the more memorable characters in the whole book.
Sheriff Root is that, you know, redneck sheriff that you see in every action movie, you know, like, I mean, you know, basically like, who's the dude like from Smokey and the Bear, you know, or Smokey and the Bandit, you know, like, you know, he's like Jackie Gleason and Smokey and the Bandit crossed with, you know, like, the sheriff from
Archie Bunker.
Crossed, you know, but again, sort of Tarantino way, you know, like,
yeah,
looking at like, you know, the,
he's not the lovable Archie Bunker.
No, I mean, he's this dude is like, you know, the unlikable,
he's just a racist redneck, yeah, you know? He's just a pig. Yeah.
And you know, and he's horrible to his son.
Yeah.
Oh, his son
the
Let's talk about Arseface.
The immortal Arseface. Man. I have not read this. I probably haven't, like I said, these issues since they first came out.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh my gosh, Arseface. Like,
I forgot how much Arseface made me laugh.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's so funny because I'm older now. I mean, I must be like, you know, obviously the book came out 20 years ago. So I'm like 20 years older. And there's a part of me that's like, I mean, I always kind of felt this way about Arseface, but like, it's kind of cruel. Like, it's just.
Oh, it absolutely is. And it is. And there's a reason for it.
Yeah.
There's a reason it's so cruel. And and it pays off. Like, that's the beautiful thing about Arseface, is that, like, if it were just like a mean joke, it would have been horrible.
Yeah.
But the way he makes Arseface pay off at the end of this series, it becomes beautiful. And like, and you really get a scope of like who he is. Like, when you look at him in the book, and like the first picture, you know, he's on that page and he's like, with like the little subtitles.
Man. Yeah, they got subtitles. And I think,
like,
about that.
What it is, it's like oh my God, it is funny because like he's this grotesque looking Arseface guy with like who has to be subtitled, but man, like you look at him and you realize he's also one of the good guys, you know?
Yeah,
like, he has just like a sweet, nice spirit, you know? He is like, he's a good person who some shitty things have happened to, which,
well, it's, you know, really funny because like when they talk about Arseface it's like these two investigators, a cop and like an FBI guy, because they've come down to investigate or look into. I'm not even sure at this point. I can't remember
because the town that
blew up. That's right.
Town that when Genesis bonds with Jesse, it blows up his town. And kills everyone in it.
Which is a great sequence in the first issue. I mean, we talked about how he gets beat up in the bar, but then he goes back to the next day is church. He did that on a Saturday, and everyone in the town shows, like when the preacher shows up talking shit at the, you know, at the bar and gets his butt kicked, everyone in the town shows up. So when Genesis like streams through the door like a bat out of hell, like quite literally, and inhabits like Jesse Custer's form, he blows up the church and everyone in it. Okay. Yeah, so, that's like, right.
So the FBI is basically in town investigating you know, what, you know, now would probably be described as a terrorist activity, but because this was, you know, pre, you know, modern terrorism, they're just sort of unsure as to what it is.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is all all of it is pre-9/11, I believe.
Yeah,
that's incredible. Yeah, it's really funny because when Arseface is sort of first talked about, he's not called Arseface, obviously, but they reveal his origin, and it's the cop talking to the FBI guy, and it's like a sad tale, but at the same
based on a real thing that happened.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah, wow!
About
when Kurt
Cobain, you know, killed himself, I guess, like they were worried. I don't know whether it was a real thing that happened or whether it was like one of those sort of parental scares that happened, but they were worried that other kids would start taking their lives in the same way.
Oh, that's interesting.
And like that was an actual like sort of fear. I remember it was on the news at the time. And so this sort of takes that story of someone who, you know, was so broken up by the death of Kurt Cobain that he shoots himself with a shotgun and basically maims himself for the rest of his life.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, mangles his face, but the way that the police officer and that describes it is like, it's really interesting because to me it's like, oh yeah, he was just this like hipster douchebag kid and kind of surly and rebellious and almost kind of got like what he deserved because, and then when you're introduced to him, obviously he survived this incident and he's alive and he's disfigured now and he's become a whole different person. He's like you said, he's sweet, he's caring, he's kind of trying to take care of his dad.
He just wants some time with his dad. He wants his dad to acknowledge him in some way.
Exactly.
Like, that's all it is. Did you ever read the Arseface one shot.
Again, it's been a long time.
Dude,
it's been a long
time. It's a good book.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the crazy thing. It's like, you know, the Preacher itself was a self-contained story, but they did one shots on limited series on a lot of the tertiary characters in here. They were all written by Garth Ennis, but they were illustrated by different artists.
Yeah. That's
and
true.
Like those were the only things, the things that were sort of outside the main canon were done by other artists. And like The Saint of Killers is a fantastic Western story. You know,
they did Arseface one on Cassidy too. Yeah,
the Cassidy one's great. You know, it's a fun little vampire story. The Arseface one is like a great little sort of like growing up in a small town, like.
Yeah.
Slice of life filled with like sort of a stoner comedy too, you know?
Yeah.
And then of course there's the one about the brothers.
Yeah. That's right.
Which is like basically, you know, what the characters though, they're introduced, later on, but yeah, it's essentially basically a grindhouse, like shoot 'em up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, it's the whole Arseface thing is just like, especially when he gets introduced, it's just crushing because you see like he's trying to get his dad's approval. He obviously knows that he's messed up. He knows that his dad is all he has, but his dad is such a prick that he mm-hmm. just he can't deal with him. He's just disgusted with his son in every way, shape, or form, and it's just crushing him. And in that panel, you sort of get like a sympathetic moment for Sheriff Root, but like as the series goes on, you're like, yeah, no. Like I had maybe a moment of pity for you because you lost your wife and your kid tried to blow his face off, but you're a scumbag. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, at this point, you know, Jesse Tulip and Cassidy are kind of like on the run together. They've become the three musketeers.
Exactly. They're on the run. They're looking for God, you know, and they're not exactly sure where to find him.
Yeah.
But it's also at this time we're introduced to the other member who's traveling with them.
Yeah. Unbeknownst
the
to
Ghost. Of John Wayne?
Yeah.
You know, it's really never, honestly, it's never clear in this book what John Wayne is.
Well,
whether
I always...
he's like sort of a mental projection of Jesse's or whether, you know, it's like the actual spirit of John Wayne.
Well, yeah, I mean, they never really addressed it. I always thought it was kind of a hallucination, you know, that he had very much like what's his face, Christian Slater in True Romance,
where he
talks to Elvis all the time, you know.
Yes.
And I thought it was very much in that vein. I always was like, oh, this is sort of like the Elvis thing, and it's great because they never show his face. You know, you never get a chance to see him. And it's, I love the moment where they describe sort of the first time he ever like spoke to John Wayne later in the series, where it's like, I was watching TV and, you know, I was just sitting there and all of a sudden, you know, I was watching a John Wayne movie and then John Wayne was talking to me like out of the TV or something like that. And it's just, it's just such a really great device to use, you know, because again, Dylan nails it. He keeps the guy's face in shadow, but like it like is very dramatic with his angles and, you know, the angles that he uses, and you know, it never becomes like silly or kind of ridiculous. Like they really use like the John Wayne mythos to its fullest extent here without actually calling him out, you know,
as
using
John
his
Wayne.
Face.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, as John Wayne. He's just this like mysterious figure, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's just, it's such a great device, you know? It's one of the things that I loved during the series because like whenever Jesse was sort of like in a bad way, you know, the John Wayne guy would pop up.
Yeah, he's basically sort of like the
spirit,
you know,
guide.
The Jiminy Cricket of this story.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Like he's the conscience. He's the guy, you know, who tells him, you know, what's right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, and what's great is that, and this is, again, what ties beautifully back into the theme of the whole story, he's always had that. He doesn't need This is not something that was given to him by Genesis. It's not something that's a gift or thing. It's something that he came up with on his own.
Yeah.
It's the central story of Preacher. You know, the idea of we need to be enough for ourselves. We need to be good enough to be good people, not out of like a fear of God, not out of a desire for reward or thing, but just because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah. And that's the thing is, like, I mean, it's in its most simplistic form, I'm not a John Wayne fan at all, but I have seen enough John Wayne movies to know that that was sort of a part of that simplistic morality, sort of almost a conservative morality during the 40s and 50s, where it was like right is right. Like, you don't mess around, you don't hit women, you don't, you know what I mean? Like, you don't, might is not right. You've got to struggle to do the right thing all the time. So it's another thing that, like you said, it just like really cements Jesse's character. It really is like, wow, not only is he a guy who has a code, but it's enforced by this being that follows him around and is a part of his like subconscious in like a really concrete way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's just great. So, I mean, by the end of the second issue, they get into a bar fight. Things get a little hairy, because they're having fun. And Cassidy stands revealed as a vampire.
Great ending, too,
Fantastic.
Because like you've got this beautiful fist fight going on and stuff like that. He gets stabbed in the eye. And it doesn't bother him at all.
Yeah.
And then, like, cut to, you see Jesse and Tulip's horrified faces. And, like, he's sitting there with this guy's, like, throat ripped out. And he's just like, whoa, something's the matter? Like, what's wrong?
Like, what's wrong? Like, yeah, exactly.
Like, he's genuinely confused that these people aren't, like, aren't like on his side about this.
Yeah, exactly. Like he rips the guy's throat open with his teeth, and then he's very much like what? Like what's wrong? Like it's just something that happens in the normal course of events. But what I really love about this panel is that, the last splash page is the fact that there's no fangs. Like they didn't resort to any cheesy sort of like stereotypical vampire behavior. There was no like like hissing or anything like that. It was just like he gets stabbed in the eye and he's like, oh yeah, hold on, I'm gonna be right with you. And then the next thing you see is like he's tearing the guy's throat out to the point where you or I would do, you know what I'm saying? What's his face did in The Walking Dead when he was that one like momentous scene in the series where he's like, his son is about to get like assaulted by these rednecks on the road and Rick has to, finally just lose it,
Where,
and he rips the guy's throat out with his teeth. Like it's very much like that. It's not sort of like a Hollywood cheesy like two puncture marks in the neck.
It's messy.
Yeah, it's
like
messy.
Everything else in this book, it's messy. Yeah,
it's messy. It's such a good revelation. And the thing that the greatest thing about it at that point is that you could also be like, wait a minute, because it leaves you hanging, sort of like, is this guy a vamp or is he just crazy?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Is he just a dude who's ripping a guy's throat out? You know what I mean? Yeah. So, I mean, at that point, after that, Jesse uses...
And that's just the second issue,
man.
That's
just the second issue. I know. It's just...
All of that, and it's just the second issue.
It's just the second issue. Yeah, I mean, from then on, it's basically like... You have Jesse. Jesse gets freaked out. He tells Cassidy to screw off. He calls him an abomination. Mm-hmm. And Cassidy like splits. And of course, in the due course of events, they eventually all start. They all kind of like, reunite. And in the meantime, the cops are still, trying to chase him down.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's just the first arc of the series, like really. Oh, what is it? Yeah, I'm looking at the part now where that this is when Cassidy decides to go back after he's after he leaves and is like, screw you. He sees the massacre that
the Saint of Killers,
has caused. And he actually encounters him and tries to take him
out. And tries to punch him. I mean, like, that's like the that's one of the things, too, where you're just like, at that point, you're like, wow, like, is he crazy? You know, you get the idea that, like, wow, he's not just a vampire. He is a crazy vampire. He's like, he's fearless, dude.
Yeah.
Like, literally, I mean, in so many ways, he comes across as fearless. And that's what makes it heartbreaking, too, is that by the end of this, you know, as the show, as the book progresses, you realize that he's probably the most scared person ever. You know, inside, he's terrified.
Well, Cassidy is very much like, he does a lot of things during the course of the series that obviously he can get hurt because he's a vampire. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's courageous in that sort of, you know how everyone's always like, oh, Superman's, it's easy to be courageous because you're bulletproof. You're, you know what I'm saying? But when things get really complex, you know, we're dealing with the guy who's been around for like at least 100 years, and he sees people in a very different way than you or I do. You know what I mean? Not just as food, but he sees them as, he sees like his actions not really having real repercussions in a way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Because, you know, he can always just walk away from it.
Exactly. He's not invested, you
right.
know.
Yeah, he's not invested in humanity.
Yeah,
that's a
exactly.
great way to put it.
Yeah.
And also during this time, we get a little alone time with Jesse and Tulip. You know? And, you know, they just keep alluding to, you know, to the past and things not working out. And, like, you know, it's very painful between them.
Yeah. Yeah. You can see that. And this is another sequence where I think, you know, Dylan's artwork just really shines because he's really great at expressions. There's a lot of close-ups and there's a lot of ways that a conversation like this can be boring in a book, you know what I mean? But he uses like extreme close-ups, angles, you know, he leaves a lot of space for the balloons, you know what I'm saying? And it's just like this guy is a pro from start to finish. And, you know, by the end of this issue, you know, Sheriff Root catches up to them.
Yeah,
you know,
gets the drop on them basically at their hotel room where they've been hiding out.
Yeah,
And you know, you also get, you know, Jesse has just also had a vision where he's realized sort of the true and, you know, story behind Genesis. You know, basically gets sort of a big data dump, you know, in his head, figures out what's going on. And, you know, he's just trying to figure out at this point, like, how to find out more information about this thing in his head.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah,
what does he decide to do? He's like, well, I'm going to go ask that Saint of Killers guy because, you know, he seems to be, you know, he seems to be clued into the whole heaven-hell situation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, it's really interesting, too, because, I mean, once you get to the fourth issue, you do see that scene where it's like, first time John Wayne spoke to me, I was 5 years old, not long after seeing my daddy get shot through the head. So obviously that's the thing that I remembered when I was reading it this time, something happened to his father. So the John Wayne thing is sort of a substitute for the lack of a male parental figure. You know what I mean? And it's sort of that's really interesting because as somebody who lost their dad when they were really young, I sort of identify with that, like latching onto iconography or something iconic, a character.
Yeah.
You know, to sort of establish your own morality. That's like really deep stuff in this.
Exactly,
book.
It is. Yeah. And the way they throw it out there, like, so matter of fact and so, like, you know, like, yep, this is what happened and this is the way, and it just, you know, I love that they're able to sort of take their time. If you, it's one of those books where like you can breeze through it like an action movie if you want to.
Yeah.
But if you sit back and like let those little scenes play out and think about like sort of what's going on and how they're showing it, like it's this is like a masterclass in how to like write a comic book, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. I think it's a masterclass on how to write a comic book and how to draw a comic book.
Yeah.
I really just think like the dialogue is perfect. The you know, the sequence of I can't say it enough of his artwork, like how he plays things out on a page is fantastic. I just like there here's this perfect bit of like dialogue where Cassidy realizes that the Saint of Killer is going after Jesse, and he's mm-hmm. coming back in the truck, and he's like talking to himself, and his guts are ripped out because he got shot by the Saint of Killers, and he's basically like, why am I doing this? Like kind of like talking himself back into, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Okay, well, this is crazy, but I'm going to do it anyway. You know what I mean?
Going to do it anyway. Yep.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you know the way he tries to stop the Saint of Killers is fantastic. He basically just tries to run him over with a truck.
Exactly.
While screaming, "Yermaza hur."
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
and it fails miserably. It's another one of those fantastic moments of miserable fail that this book shows so well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's really great too, because at this point, you know, Jesse and Tulip, they've been captured by Root. Mm-hmm. And they're sort of in like, you know, for lack of a better term, a Mexican standoff, right?
Right.
It's like, he's going to blow Tulip's head off. And she's like, I'm going to blow your head off. And you know that they're both crazy enough to sort of do it. And then who shows up? The Saint of Killers. And yeah. then right after the Saint of Killers shows up, it's like things go from bad to worse. It's like Saint
but of Killers. But then it's hilarious. I mean, like he hits him. And like, you know, the Saint of Killers is the ultimate sort of immovable object.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
So this car just like evaporates, you know, as yeah. it hits him. He throws through the windshield and like, you know, flying, you know, head over ass all over the asphalt, just tearing himself up, lands yeah. by Jesse, and it's like, cheer up, man. You're rescued.
Yeah, exactly. But he's so obviously not, you know. But it's,
you know,
like
it's a great punchline, and like, and that's that moment too where like that friendship is totally cemented.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It's great. It's great. It's great. And then again, you know, this is and which leads to the iconic moment of Arseface where he comes running out and is like, please don't kill my dad, you know.
It's done like a Sergio Leone movie.
Yeah.
You know? Like he comes running in, like screaming, you know, don't kill my dad. And then you've got like the little shot of every character's face in yeah. this like middle of this tense standoff. And what's Cassidy do? Oh, I just got a face like an R.
Yeah. It's just like, oh my God. Like I'll never forget that. Like it's so funny. It just brought such a smile to my face because I was like, oh my gosh. Like I remember that. Like, and it's such a great moment in the series because it just like establishes this guy's, moniker, you know, and it's, but at the same time, it's just like, oh, it's so sad. You're like, you don't want anybody to be called Arseface. You know what
no,
I mean?
No, you don't.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so Jesse gets fed up. He's like, enough.
And he discovers that the word works on the Saint of Killers.
Exactly.
Which is kind of awesome. And that's where he ends up getting his information from. He makes him call down the angels who are in charge.
Yep.
And they basically break it to him, the whole thing that God's gone, you know, came to the angels one day, said he was going on a journey to Earth. That's it. Done.
Yeah. Well, they even say it's like in this dialogue. Now I remember they say he quit. And yeah. then Jesse's like, how can God quit?
Yeah.
And they're just like, he quit, you know, he just like left. He doesn't care anymore. He's done. And then this is when you sort of get the big quest, which is mm-hmm. like, Jesse's like, okay, I've got this thing, Genesis in me, and
makes people do what they, you know, makes people do what I want.
Yeah.
So what's he going to do? He's like, well, no one will believe me unless they hear it from God himself. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to find him no matter what, and I'm going to make him tell everybody what he did.
Exactly. I'm going to make him answer for abandoning his creation, I think is what he says.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you realize that like, wow, this dude is like crazy in his own way, like in a way that's like, you know, he's the good guy, but he's crazy in a good way too.
Yeah. It's really interesting because, you know, the thing that I really find, just the whole way that this thing plays out is just like fantastic. Like, and the whole thing of like God quitting and I remember when I first started to read the book, remembering the quest of like, you know, that he was going to go find God. And I was like, wait a minute, how does he find God? And then in this thing, they say dead out, like he went to Earth. And that's when I was like, oh, okay, he's on Earth. You know, I was like, well, God could go anywhere, like, you know, but they specifically say that God is on Earth. So at that point, like in my brain, while I was rereading the series, it reminded me, I'm like, okay, so this is where, you know, this is how he can find him, because he's going to go, you know, he's going to go, you know, like Sam L. Jackson said in Pulp Fiction, go walk the Earth. And I'm going to find God and I'm going to make him answer for it, which is interesting, you know, because, yeah, I mean, and that becomes the underlying quest of the whole series, you know, and, you know, what drives everything is like his desire, his drive to get God to stand in front of him, you know, and answer.
And just explain why, you know, basically it's you know, the sort of the ultimate human question there. Why?
Yeah. Like, why did you leave us? And then, you know, and then of course, all this heavy information is topped off at the end where, I don't know if it's ironically or whatever, but, Sheriff Root, while he's being carted off into the,
there's a reason why he's being carted off into the ambulance.
Yeah.
Because Jesse uses the word on him and tells him to go fuck himself.
Yeah.
Yeah. He does.
Yeah, he does.
I mean, it's one of those horrible, horrible things, you know, like they're loading him like into the ambulance and they're explaining to Arsface, your father's severed penis is stuck in his colon.
It's an
hour too late for microsurgery, but at least he's stable.
Yeah. And then he ends up blowing his own head off, you know, right in front of Arsface. So it's just really funny, the thing that Arsface tried to, you know, end himself with, his father ends up doing, obviously for understandable reasons. But it's such a great scene too, because Arsface like runs off into the dark like, dad, and then the FBI guy's like, well, fuck me.
And what's like, interesting too, is that like it sort of that parallels Jesse's quest for God too. You know, you've got Arsface basically who's after him, you know, while he's after somebody else, you know. It's another very Western like sort of subplot, the idea of like, you know, the hunter, somebody who's hunting somebody else who's also being hunted themselves. But he's hunted by Arsface, and he actually has the comic book speech of like, I will have my vengeance, you know. Arsface.
It's pretty hysterical, you know. And it's funny because they leave things kind of like wide open. They insinuate that things are, you know, coming, you know, in a big way. But at the same time, this last fourth issue, it could also very much be an ending. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you could just read these four issues and just be happy with that. Obviously, I don't know how you would do that, but, you know, it's...
Dude, it's a great pilot. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, one of those things that even if it had been like just a four issue, you know, limited series or whatever, like that would have been a strong pilot. You know, like people would have wanted more books after that. And again, like I can't believe that I did not like dig it the first time I read it.
Yeah, that blows me away, man.
Yeah, but like I said, I think I was a different person the first time that I read it.
Yeah.
Like when I read it the second time, it just hit me in all those right places, like you said. And, you know, it's definitely one of my favorite stories.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, the other half of the book is three issues leading up to issue 7. They actually go to New York and they kind of reunite with Cassidy, an old journalist friend of Cassidy.
Trying to get information on God.
Yeah.
And, you know, we should talk about that another time.
You definitely.
Know? It's, like it's got its own like story, and we find out a lot more interesting stuff.
Yeah, yeah. But I should just say that it's at this point where you at that those next three issues, you definitely sort of get the feel that it's really cemented, like how crazy this thing is going to get, and
oh, yeah.
how well fleshed out even like characters that you're never going to see again are like mm-hmm. like the thing that's so great. And you know, just talking about these first four issues is how many different characters are in there. A lot, even just small ones. How many do you end up like feeling something for? Pretty much almost everybody in one way or another, you know. And I'm saying, like, there's a depth to each character, that each character is given like even a small moment to like shine in the sun, no matter how kind of tertiary they are to like the main plot. Yeah. Like he does, Ennis did like a really great job of just fleshing everything out, making everything work, and you know, just keeping everything solid for the whole thing. And it's funny, you know, because you said you're obviously I was in a different place in my life when I first started reading this, you know, and 20 years later, I still think it's like these first seven issues, or at least the very first four, to me are like is some of the greatest comic stuff I've ever read, you know.
Yeah.
And
it's so fun too, like that's just the thing that comes across like in this whole book is that like these guys were just having a freaking blast.
Yeah, I mean, you could tell they were having fun and they were riffing. And honestly, to me, it's like when a rock star is at the height of their powers. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They're just like, this is it. And I'm going all the way with this. And I honestly don't think that Ennis has done anything even close to coming to the greatness of Preacher. You know what I mean? Or even just, heck, you know, screw Ennis. Just a lot of comic book creators in general. You know, for me, Preacher is the thing that's just going to loom large for a very long time, you know.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that whenever a movie came up or a TV show came up or stuff like that when I was younger, I was like, you know what, I don't need that. And you know, like when we were younger comic book fans, everyone sort of needs like a TV show or a movie to sort mm-hmm. of validate, you know, comics or their hobby or something like that. With Preacher's always the one thing that I recall just being like, it's pure, it's perfect the way it is. I don't need anything else. And I know that AMC is coming out with the show, but I mean, I'm very trepidatious about it, you know. Like
I understand that, you know. But again, here's the cool thing is like, no matter what they do with that show, that doesn't take anything away from this.
No, absolutely not. And honestly, I don't know. I think that this thing is kind of unfilmable in a way. I don't know, because it's not even just the violence. It's just like what they're talking about and the sort of like, you know, irreverent way that they're talking about the things that they're talking about. You know what I mean?
Yep.
I mean, there's no way that a TV show is going to get away with the stuff that they get away with. I mean, I know I thought that about Walking Dead, you know, when they were making a TV show. I was like, there's mm-hmm. no way. But this is kind of like, we're dealing with religion, we're dealing with things that are very sacred to people, and sort of like, you know, to borrow a British phrase, to take the piss out of it, you know, which Preacher very much does through the course of its run, you know, the establishments of religion, you know, the church, you know, dude, I don't know how they're going to get away with it, but I know that I'll check it out. So, you know, obviously I won't be able to resist, you know, so
this is fun. One of our first conversations that we ever had together was talking about Preacher.
Yeah, so it must have been.
I think that this is like a fun little like retrospective. It's cool to look back over the years, 20 something years, man.
Dude.
Like 20 years. Like that blows me away.
Yeah.
You know, that we're able to still talk about this thing and it's like still just as cool as it was then.
Yeah, it's still as powerful. I was just looking at the Wikipedia page. It says the main characters, Jesse Custer, Tulip O'Hare, Cassidy, Saint of Killers, Hare Star, who doesn't get introduced until later, mm-hmm. God, and the last character is Arse Face. I love it. Yes, Arseface, last but not least. Let's just put it that way. Yeah, so, all right. We couldn't explore the last three issues because we've kind of gone on and on about the first four in this trade. But the last three are just as messed up as the first four. And it's in New York City. So that's all I can say, you know, to the listeners, like that if you can track Preacher down, you know, this is a book that I think will blow you away if you've never read it, you know.
Absolutely.
And for me, it is really, I think it's number one. I can't say anything more. Like, I think this is the greatest comic book reading experience I've ever had, reading this book. And when it ended at issue 66, again, it made me cry. And it made me cry because I felt the loss, you know?
Yeah.
I felt the loss of this thing that I had been reading for 5 years at least, and just like grown so attached to. So hopefully, if you decide to pick up Preacher after you listen to this, or if you decide to reread it, you'll have just as powerful an experience. Because for me, you know, this was like, this was one of those moments that just blew the back of my head out, you know, much like the Saint of Killers did to that poor angel. All right. So, okay, so this has been the Preacher Gone to Texas episode of Part-Time Fanboy. We didn't even really introduce ourselves.
Oh, that's okay. I'm Paul.
I'm Christian Horn, and this has been another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. Thanks for listening. The Part-Time Fanboy Book Club.
Part-Time Fanboy Book Time. Y'all come back now, you hear?
All right. In famous Texas style. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
Yeah, doing part-time.